Good evening. KQRIW here. And at the time, begin the TechNet. For those who haven't heard the TechNet before, its major purpose is education. A little bit of entertainment sneaks in. And the subject, of course, is ham radio. And the 26 different kinds of ham radio. Maybe 27 different kinds. Person signs in with a question or a comment by giving us your call letters, your name, and the confirming yes. And the yes means you do have a question or comment for the net. And you could say no if you're just checking in. Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW listening.
K2, Mike Oscar, Tony, yes.
Whiskey 2, Echo, Whiskey Kilo, Eugene, yes.
W2CNJ, Bob, yes.
Take the other question.
Okay, we had a few triples that time, but I got Tony, Eugene, and Bob. Who did we miss?
AC2BYZ, Dan, yes, I have a question.
Okay, we've got Tony, Eugene, Bob, Dan. I bet you we've also got a Mel, K2KEY. Mel, are you there?
I am. Good evening, all.
Okay. So the whole Hell Hill, the gang's all here. Any other check-ins besides those that we just mentioned, please give me a call with his name right now.
And you have Paul, WS2N. Good evening, Dick.
WS2N. Very good, Paul. You might be interested to know that of all the email that Mel and I get, some of the most positive email we get is that people just love hearing about what the astronauts are doing in NASA. So you're a popular fellow. Please keep it up. Okay. Our first person who signed was Tony, Kilo 2 Mike Oscar. What would you like to ask us tonight, Tony? K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. Nice to see you. This is K2MO. I have a few questions about signal distortion caused by disturbances in the polar ionosphere, Dick. I've been playing around with a ionospheric simulator and deciphering recordings of real signals over the pole, the VE8 Alpha Tango beacon, for instance. After slowing the speed of the recordings and viewing them in the audio spectrum, I could see a clearer picture of the wavering Doppler, the wavering signal in general. And it seems to be consistent with the description Davies gives in his book, Ionospheric Radio for Polar Flutter, Polar Distortion. If I understand it correctly, convection in the F region is responsible for setting polar irregularities in motion, and it's their high speed that causes these Doppler shifts and signal spread over the poles. I often see polar distortion described as something that's caused by multipath alone, but it would seem that in order to have Doppler, you'd have to have movement within the ionosphere. And the question basically is, can phase changes or multipath alone cause Doppler shift without the motion of these irregularities? Dick, does the ionosphere have to actually move in order to have Doppler, or can it be due to multipath, of whether it's high ray, low ray, or you know, whatever the case may be for multipath? Dick, this is K2MO. Over.
Very fine, Tony. Before we proceed, you probably said it, but I didn't catch it. What frequency are you listening to a polar ionospheric propagation? Go ahead.
Yeah, basically I've been monitoring the VE8 Alpha Tango beacon because it's a steady signal. It's a carrier signal. It's the beacon that's located right near the North Pole, Dick. And of course you have to wait for a magnetic disturbance to really see some Doppler spread. So that's what I've been doing.
Okay. For the rest of us who are a little bit naive, you still haven't told me the frequency. I know it's the VE8 Alpha Tango beacon. And if I was real smart, I'd know what frequency that's on, and I don't. Please tell me, Tony.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dick. It's 14-100, and of course it transmits on the other bands, 18-110, 21-150, 24-930, and 28-200. Dick, it's the NCDXF beacon network, but specifically I've been listening to it on the 20-meter band, 14-100.
Where is the beacon located?
It's probably in BE-8 land. Is that where the beacon is located, Tony, if you happen to know?
Yes, it's very close to the poles, Dick. I forget the exact location, but it's very close to the North Pole.
Now, BE-8 is approximately in the Vancouver area. If I go dead north, and I presume we're talking about the Canadian territories, is that true?
That's true, Dick. I could get the exact location for you if you give me a second.
Not required, Tony. Okay. And your basic question is, in order to get a Doppler shift, does it have to be motion? Does there have to be real velocity involved? I say no. Multipath can do it. I'll explain how. And this is very similar to what happens with FM reception on a limiter discriminator. Let's assume now that I'm studying my limiter discriminator on my FM receiver, and I'm plugging a signal in the IF strip. Assume the IF strip runs at 10.7 megs, so I've got a signal generator at 10.7 megs. And I've really got two signal generators. I've got a pair of independent signal generators. They're both frequency synthesized. I'm putting together with a power divider used backwards, so it's a power summer. And I got one common output port from the two signal generators. And let's assume now that the two signal generators have a common reference oscillator, a 10 meg reference oscillator, and they're both locked to the exact same 10 meg oscillator. So the two signals are on the exact same frequency, and they're thoroughly coherent. But now let me put a longer piece of cable from one signal generator into the power divider, power summer, as opposed to the other. And let me make it a 90 degrees of extra cable length, an extra quarter wave of cable. Alrighty. So signal generator number two is the one that's 90 degrees lagging because it's got a longer piece of cable. Signal generator number one is the one that has no extra piece of cable, so it's the 0 degree phase signal generator. I start off with signal generator number one at a nice high amplitude, and signal generator at a very low amplitude. The two signal generators represent multipath. In other words, multipath, in general, the signal comes from the exact same location, but there's two different ways it can get there, and that's what I've got here. Two signal generators represent two different ways it can get there, and I'm really only using the signal generators because I can adjust the step attenuator or the variable attenuator in the output. So I start off with a strong signal from number one at zero in phase, and I look at what's going on the discriminator. Later on, I start cranking up signal generator number two, and as signal generator number two becomes louder than signal generator number one, I now am listening to a 90-degree phase-delayed signal. So, obviously, the stronger signal generator number two, when I turn it up, it captures the limiter, and therefore the phase of my output is due to sig gen number two. So, by operating with signal generator number one, stronger or weaker than sig generator number two, fiddling back and forth between the two, I can be shifting phase without moving any phase. I'm only changing amplitude. So picture now a multipath situation where you've got a more direct signal coming to your receiver and a more indirect signal, and depending on the state of the ionosphere, one of those signals can get stronger than the other. One of those paths, we'll say, is over water, and the wind blows, the sea state changes, so the water becomes not a nice smooth piece of glass, but something that's more obscure. I get less of a signal from the water, and so you can see how there's multiple ways that multipath can give you what looks like Doppler shift as you slowly swish from one signal to the other, one path to the other, even though no motion took place. Now, a guy who is a good scientist will say, well, wait a minute here, Dick. Yeah, you didn't create any Doppler by the direct technique of making something move, but by the way you shifted amplitudes electronically, you created what looks like motion. Well, the ionosphere can do that. And is that motion, or is it just a change in amplitude? It's a matter of opinion. So I think, let me pass it back to you, Tony, and see if you see the image that I'm trying to draw mentally here. And by the way, one hell of a technical question. K2 Mike Oscar, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, I thought so, Dick. Yeah, I see your point. And well, let me ask you another question then. Is it possible then to add, by phase changes, is it possible to add 10 to even possibly 30 hertz of Doppler shift or signal spread, so to speak, that we see in the polar ionosphere with phase changes alone without actually having the motion that's supposedly up there due to these irregularities flying around and circulating. Is it possible to have up to 30 hertz or 20 hertz of spread there with these phase changes? Over.
Inside of a very well-equipped laboratory, Tony, the answer is yes. It's called Serodyne Modulation. S-E-R-R-O-D-Y-N-E. And hopefully that's now in open literature. It has to be. It's been around for an awful long period of time. By way of a phase-shifting network that you use cyclically, you can take a signal generator into an amplifier assembly. You can make the output frequency of the amplifier assembly be different than the input frequency without any mixing, without any local oscillator, without any superheterodyning taking place. It's called serodyning. And the way that it was done most classically in the past is by taking a traveling wave tube and slowly changing the voltage on the helix. As you change the voltage on the helix of a traveling wave tube, you are making the beam going down the center of the tube go slightly faster or slightly slower. And as you slowly change the helix voltage, it may only take about 5 or 10 volts of change out of 5,000 volts. 5 volts of shift can give you 360 degrees of phase shift. A traveling wave tube can do that. I fiddled with them over quite a few years on a number of electronic countermeasures programs, and I've seen them do that. They do it very well. So once you realize that changing the helix voltage makes a minor change in the velocity, but there's so many wavelengths of the signal inside of that tube, so to speak, you can easily slow it down a little bit and make 360 degrees of phase shift. Now, if I do that with a sawtooth waveform, let's say, for instance, I have a rising voltage, which is giving me an increase in phase, and I go from 0 to 360 degrees in a... you would call it the straight line portion of the hypotenuse of the sawtooth wave. Then when I reach 360, I instantaneously jump back down to the starting voltage and repeat the process. So I instantaneously jump from 360 back to zero, which is the exact same point. If I do this with enough skill, I can do this in a continuous manner. If I did it at one cycle per second, the frequency coming out would be exactly one hertz higher than the one that went in. If I did it at 10 kilohertz, the signal coming out would be 10 kilohertz higher. There's a catch. And the catch is the accuracy. If I flip from 0 to 5 volts, we'll say, and jump back to 0, and if I don't do it accurately enough, if I'm not shifting at exactly 360 back to 0, I shift at 355 back to 0, or if in the ramp portion of the sawtooth, if I don't do it with enough accuracy, the net result, when you look at the spectrum analyzer output, is, yeah, the signal shifted there, we'll say, 10 kilohertz higher, because I'm doing this at a 10 kilohertz rate. There's a signal there at 10 kilohertz. There's a simultaneous signal there without the 10 kilohertz of offset. So you only negate the original signal if you do it with high accuracy. So the fact that I can do it with a traveling wave tube in a laboratory, you're now about to ask me, can the ionosphere do that? And I think the answer is probably no. For the ionosphere to give you a continuous sample shift of some number of hertz or kilohertz, I think really requires motion of a reflecting surface or motion of a refracting surface. The signal gets to the ionosphere, everybody calls it a bounce. It's really not a bounce. It's an absorption and re-emission at the molecular level, and it really becomes a kind of refraction. It's a wave-bending phenomenon. It's not a real bounce. But can the phase center of that bounce shift as a function of time? Absolutely. The magnetic field is always moving. The state of the ionosphere, its level of ionization is a function of what is the solar wind doing right now. Is there a solar expulsion, a mass expulsion taking place? The sun can do some terrible things, good and bad, so to speak, to the ionosphere. So, for a continuous shift, I think real velocity of a reflecting, I call it reflecting, I put it in quotes, it's really a refraction. A motion of that surface is required. When you combine it with multipath in and out, you can flip back and forth in phase, but I'm having trouble believing that Mother Nature flipping back and forth in phase between two multipath signals can do it with enough accuracy to really create a clear Ceradyne, if you know what I mean. If you look up the word Ceradyne in a good book, like, for instance, Skolnick's book called The Radar Handbook by Skolnick, S-K-U-L-N-I-K, I think it's S-K-O-L, I'm not sure of the spelling of his name, but he's got a darn good book called The Radar Handbook, which now must be in the fourth or fifth edition. And if you go to the index and look up Ceradyne, you'll find out quite a bit more about this. And now the question is, can the ionosphere do it? K2, Mike Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick, K2, Mike Oscar. Very interesting. Very interesting, but I think you answered my question. I guess it is more of a movement up there than it is. But like as you say, phase changes can cause Doppler shift, but I think what you're saying is that motion of the ionosphere and the chaotic nature through the polar ionosphere is probably something that's caused more by these irregularities moving around and a refractive medium moving than more so than phase shifts, even though it can happen through phase shifting. One more question, Dick. It's the same subject, but as far as I've worked a 6 meter backscatter off the aurora, and of course there's it differs from HF signals, I guess, moving through the aurora or the polar regions, I should say, and I've noticed that the signal spread is much wider on the signals that backscatter from the aurora regions, and the spread or Doppler is probably limited to something like, I don't know, maybe 10 to 20, 30 hertz signal spread as signals travel through the ionosphere. I was just wondering, off the top of your head, Dick, if you would say one is backscatter has much more, or is expected to have much more Doppler spread than signals on HF traveling through the ionosphere, Dick.
Yeah, it's a function now of what creates Doppler. It's really how many wavelengths per second is the object in motion creating. If I had a transmitter at exactly 100 megacycles, 100 megacycles is, I think, 3 meters, if that transmitter is on a railroad train, I'm standing at the station, and the railroad train is traveling away from me, and he transmits exactly 100 megacycles, and because the wavelength is 3 meters, every time he moves 3 meters away from me, I see 360 degrees of phase shift. If his velocity happened to be 100 meters per second, which would be, I should know what that is in miles per hour, take my word for it, 100 meters per second would be 33 wavelengths per second. Therefore, him traveling away from me at 100 meters per second, transmitting 100 megacycle signal, I would see a signal 33 hertz lower before we get into relativistic effects. Or if he's traveling toward me, I would see a signal 33 hertz higher because he's going through that many wavelengths. If I was doing a radar experiment, and on that railroad train is a great big reflector, and I'm transmitting radar pulses to the back of the train, hitting the reflector, coming back to me, and the train is moving, again, 100 meters per second, instead of 33 hertz of Doppler shift, I would see 66 hertz of Doppler shift before we get into relativistic effects. So that's because the signal has got to go out to the reflector and back. That total path length, even though the train is moving 100 meters per second, the total path length back to me is getting longer by 200 meters per second. So I see 66 hertz of Doppler shift in that particular experiment. So from this you can tell, the higher the frequency, the greater the Doppler for the same amount of velocity. So one simple way of you re-deriving the program, the formula, so to speak, is to recognize the fact that it's a really how fast is the path growing or shrinking. This came out very exciting for me when for 4 solid years, over the 4.5 years, starting in approximately 1982, K4CAW, a guy named Al in Greensboro, North Carolina, put up 4 very good Yagis on 100 feet of power. KQLIW in Huntington, put up 16 very good Yagis on 100 feet of power. Each had a kilowatt of power on 432. So on every single Tuesday night from 7:30 to 8 o'clock for 4.5 years, we talked to each other over a 480-mile pass. My radio horizon is 40 miles out. He gets 480 airline miles from me. And most of that pass is inland, not over water. And we had 90% copy of single sideband over that pass, summer, winter, spring, and fall. By the way, the copy was higher in the winter, the percentage of copy, even though the signal was stronger on average in the summer. There was a very deep phase in the summertime due to multipath. In the wintertime, there was essentially one very reliable pass. However, on each one of these half-hour skids, approximately twice, his signal, which would average about 2 dB above my threshold, single sideband threshold, and because we had a nice protocol that we used, we knew exactly what we were going to say. There's 1 or 2 minutes of transmission in each direction, timed to the clock. We were giving signal strength and just describing the characteristics of what we saw. We were studying propagation. And so summer, winter, spring, and fall, twice per half hour, the signal would peak up 30 decibels above threshold. When the signal normally would be 2 dB above threshold, it would peak up 30 dB, hang there for about 2 or 3 minutes, and go back down. However, when the signal did that, I would hear a tone that started off as a very high pitch. The signal got stronger and stronger. It went through 0 beats. Then the signal would be, go through a higher and higher pitch, get weaker and weaker, and disappear. Had a whole lot of questions for a long time as to what it was. Finally figured it out. There's a number of commercial airliners flying from New York City to Florida. They fly directly over Washington, D.C., the midpoint between Huntington, Long Island, and Greensboro, North Carolina. The midpoint was over the Chesapeake Bay. Aircraft flying there at 30,000 feet were in direct line of sight of him and me. And the reflection of the aircraft was giving us 30 decibels of enhancement. But the aircraft was not flying exactly parallel to our radio path. They were flying at a slight angle to it. So you could look like, you could make believe there was a wire going from Al's house in Greensboro to my house in Huntington. And it's like a bow, it's like the wire on a guitar, and somebody stretches the wire by pulling it out to one side. And as you stretch the wire to the right, you can see how it's a longer path. You slowly release it, and it goes to the shorter path, and then you stretch it to the left. Well, that aircraft was doing just that. The reflection of the aircraft was flying somewhat at right angles, or at a slight angle compared to our path, and therefore we were hearing positive Doppler shift as the aircraft was approaching our midpoint. It went through zero crossing at our 0 beat at our midpoint, and as the aircraft went out the other side, we heard negative Doppler shift. Those are the tones we were hearing. And so, did I see Doppler shift for motion? My goodness. However, what that taught me is that I had been reading lots of articles in the IEEE proceeding in which various people put great big dishes as much as 600 miles apart and 10 kilowatt type transmitters, and they ran a strip recorder and recorded signal strength for days on end. And they processed the data and they talked about the statistics. Because essentially no human being was listening to that signal. It was being detected and recorded on a strip chart recorder. They didn't know what the heck they were recording. Because aircraft reflection is an extremely strong contaminant to that data. They thought they were studying Mother Nature and forward-propagated tropospheric scatter. A certain percentage of the data they've got is contaminated by aircraft reflection. And because the human being wasn't listening, they didn't know that. Very similar to the movie Contact, where Ellie was listening with her earphones and she heard something unusual as opposed to just making strip chart recording. But you get a kick out of that. K2 Mike Oscar, K2 LIW.
Now I can make comments at K2 LIW.
Okay, Mel, go ahead first and then pass it over. You pass it over directly to Tony when you're through, Mel. You got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2 KTY. Garen, experiences with the aurora and the Doppler shift years ago, I got quite interested, and I found that the intensity of the effect is directly due, of course, to the A and the K index. When you had a K index of greater than 5, you can expect very more effect of Doppler as aurora, the aurora borealis. It seems to go along, I guess, because of the ionization of the high-energy particles that were, you know, closely associated with the aurora and solar activity. Now, stations that are 42 degrees north latitude find that they have the most, you know, use of the aurora opening each year. And the CW signals, that's another thing, CW signals that were experienced on 144 megahertz sound strange because they get this distortion, so that CW signals start to sound like a buzz or a hiss or even like a sort of a whooshy sound, you know.
Yeah.
And it's, I guess, not unusual to find a Doppler shift of about 1 kilohertz that 2 meters and up to, you know, several kilohertz at 432. Then is the effect of the second Doppler shift that can increase the distortion. So you're dealing with, you know, a number of factors, but they waver. They constantly waver, Dick, and, but it seems like, again, the stations that were located 42 degrees north latitude or further, we're able to make more use of the aurora and the, on, for instance, advance down onto 10 meters, 10 and 6 meters, very, very much use of it. However, the distortion can be a real problem at times. It can get very severe, Dick, over.
It sure can. I've listened to aurora reflections on 6 meters and 2 meters and 432. The amount of Doppler shift you get on 432 is so great that a signal will not sound like a... It's more like... And as you tune your receiver across it, it goes... I wonder if you've ever heard anything like that, Tony. K2 Mike Oscar.
K2RIW. K2MO. Dick, that was just a phenomenal imitation of what the Doppler shift and sounds like, you know, auroral backscatter. That was perfect. Okay, on the airplane scatter, I've experienced that myself, believe it or not, on the scale you did. But during the summertime, we expect the sporadic ETA to come about, and I would often monitor the 6-meter band, looking for beacons and looking for openings and watching the cluster. And for the heck of it, one time I tuned to the, I think it's K2ZD or K2DZ. I think he's either upstate New York and in Jersey. I think it's less than 100 miles. Signal is very, very weak. The frequency, I think, was... 50.50685, I think he's on. And all of a sudden, I experienced the same thing you did, Dick, airplane scatter. I guess it's called, and the signal became way above my noise level and then disappeared again. And you could see I guess it's considered, what would it be called? The flutter. The flutter would start out rapidly, and then I guess when the aircraft was in a position where the signal was reflected without multipath, the signal would become steady, and then again the flutter would go ahead and become rapid again as the aircraft moved out of the signal's path, I guess you'd say. So I've experienced that with a 6-meter beacon, Dick, and I've got a better understanding of aircraft scanner, and yeah, I've worked plenty of 6-meter aurora, and as a matter of fact, Dick, even some
Believe it or not, I used to work, well, I still do, I work a lot of meteor scatter on 6 meters and occasionally on 2 meters. And I thought for a while, you know, why not make use of the 10-meter band? Why not work meteor scatter on the 10-meter band? And I got a couple of the guys on the reflector to come on 10 meters with me with, I'm sure you're familiar with them, with W1, what's his name? I know you know the guy, Dick, the guy who wrote the software for Meteor Scatter. Can't figure it right. WK1JT, Joe Taylor. We went on 10 meters, and sure enough, we were able to bounce some signals off of meteors with on the 10-meter band. Actually, much easier. And I understand that's due to the ionization of the meteor itself, and actually gets easier as on lower frequencies. So yeah, it's a lot of fun things out there to do, Dick. I guess beyond the ordinary, and I enjoy it all. I have a lot of fun with it. So I won't take any of your time, Dick. I'm sure a lot of the other guys would like to ask questions and get in here. But always a pleasure, Dick, and thanks for the answer. Very complicated subject. I guess it's very difficult to make heads or tails of the chaotic nature of the polar ionosphere. K2RIW in the group K2MO.
I think what it does, Tony, is deterministic. In other words, once you understand some of the basic mechanisms, I think it can be analyzed and to some degree predicted. I've also done rain scatter on 10 gigahertz. Individual raindrops are beautiful scatterers when you're up at 10,000 megs. And so I'll have to describe to you how I talked to people on the backside of a mountain because there was a rainstorm off to one side. And I've also done passive radar, weather radar, by listening to a 10 gigahertz beacon that was down in southern New Jersey at RCA Estro. And because the swirling winds around a low pressure center, particularly when you got precipitation coming down, if I aim my 10 gig signal to the left, I would hear positive Doppler shift. To the right, I would hear negative Doppler shift because the wind was moving in a counterclockwise manner on top view. I have to describe that all to you either later on tonight after we go through these guys or next Sunday if you want to discuss it more, Tony. You're just scratching the surface. It's one of my favorite subjects. I better move on. Eugene here is getting excited. We're keeping him waiting a long time. Whiskey 2, Echo Whiskey Kilowatt. What's the latest with you, Eugene? K2LIW.
Okay, Dick,
W2EWK.
It's Kenneth. Oh, I got a little problem tonight, but it seems as though that the people on the 146850 probably helped me. I'm looking for the man that goes to all the ham fests. He has a crippled life. His life is crippled, and he sells all of it. He has a lot of computers. I'm trying to get a hold of him to get a cheap one, you know, a slow one. Okay, that's number one. And if anyone knows his phone number, please pass my phone number to him. My phone number is 631-475-1987. I'll repeat that, 631-475-1987. And I'd like to know when they have sales on 850, you know, to sell ham gear. Sometimes on 850 they sell the ham gear. Can you tell me what date that is and what time?
Sure can, Eugene. You're talking about Bill, WB2CUK, Whiskey Bravo 2, Charlie Uncle Kilo. He's been running the swap and shop on Limark for zillions of years. I believe it's on Thursday, and I think it starts at 8:30. Can somebody on frequency correct me on that?
Okay, Dick, you said his call letters again. Go slowly with me, very slow, and I've got W2 question mark.
Okay, I'll go real slow, Eugene. He's Whiskey Bravo 2, Charlie Uncle Kilo. Whiskey Bravo 2, Charlie Uncle Kilo. Bill, I think he lives in the Farmingdale area. And I think it's Thursday night is swap and shop. If you take a look at any issue of the repeater directory, and you look in the New York State area,
in the Long Island area for Nassau County. You'll see the listing for the LIMOC repeater. You can also go on the website, LIMOC.org, www.LIMOC.org, and they list all of the nets, the weekly nets that are on LIMOC, and you'll certainly find Bill listed there. Anyone want to correct me if I'm wrong on guessing, is it Thursday night, and is it 8:30 that Bill runs the swap and shop, KQIW listening?
Listen, one more thing. Go slowly. No phonetics. Is W what? W, I didn't get his call letters. Give it to me straight, okay?
Okay, you'll get it straight. W, B, 2, C, U, K. W, B, 2, C, U, K. QSL?
Oh, QSL, WB2CUK, is that correct?
You got it. You got it right there, Eugene. So when you go to the LIMOC website on LIMOC.org, you will find the listing for all of the nets. It's also listed for 10 or 15 years at least in the ARRL repeater directory. All the nets are listed when you get to the New York State pages. So there's lots of ways for you to find out exactly how to get a hold of Bill. I didn't say his phone number is there, but if you just listen to one of his nets, you'll hear lots of phone numbers and pieces of equipment being sold, computing equipment as well as ham radio equipment. So good luck with that project, Eugene, with finding a better computer. Okay, I think Bob is the next person. W2, Papa November Juliet. You got it, Bob. KQIW.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bob, WCPNJ. I'm planning to purchase some more coax cables. I presently have the Belden 8214, the RG8 fuse type. It's got a foam polyethylene dielectric inside. It's copper grade, thin center conductor. It has a, hold on, I got the specs in front of me. It's got a velocity of 78%. Its loss is 1.2 dB per 100 foot at 50 megahertz. I'm looking for, standby, my kids are barking. I'm looking at the Belden 8267, which is also 50 ohms. It's an RG type 213U. It's got, the dielectric is polyethylene. It says polyethylene, not foam. And it's got a insertion loss of 1.3 dB per 100 feet at 50 megahertz. And its velocity is 66%. If the cost is basically the same, what do you guys recommend? I presently use the 8214, but I have to buy another 100 some off feet, and the smallest I can get is at least 500 cents. But that's not a problem, it's very easy. Over to you, Bill.
Okay, I think I know what you're asking, and it's a good question, Bob. And you're into an area where a lot of personal preference involved. I'll give you an answer that is good for me. Not everybody's going to agree with what I'm about to say. Whenever I hear of cables that have higher velocity factor than 66%, which is what you get with solid polyethylene, I know that one of two things is happening. Either the dielectric material is foamed, it's either foam polyethylene or foam Teflon, or there's an airspace in there and there's a spiral holding structure holding the semiconductor in the right place. In the case of 9913 cable, the old-fashioned stuff, that airspace ran into a serious problem. On a hot day, the air expanded. On a cold day, it contracted. On a rainy day, it started up with a hot day with expanded air inside, where it has already outgassed. The rain comes along. You've got a coating of water on the outside of the cable. The rain cools off the cable. The air inside contracts and sucks in the water. So lots and lots of people have had lots of trouble with 9913 outdoors. I believe the 9914 and the various dash numbers have a foil wrap underneath the polyethylene, polyvinyl chloride outer coating. By the way, how did the water get in there? Either it leaked in from the end because the connectors are not perfectly sealed, or in the case of foam-filled cable, one of my favorite cables used to be SM8, a cable that was popular in the late 70s. It was made by the ITT company, and it had foam polyethylene center conductor braid outside of that, and a nice polyvinyl jacket on the outside. I use it for the phasing harness on my array of 16 Yagis. Well, 4 years later when I brought the 16 Yagis down, well, Hurricane Gloria did that for me, brought my 16 Yagis down and deposited them into my front yard from the top of my 100-foot tower. I decided to take that phasing harness apart and measure those cables. And every one of those cables, the insertion loss in decibels per foot, so to speak, more than doubled. What had happened in every one of the cables increased by almost exactly the same amount. I mean, you can either assume that every one of those 16 cables going to those 16 Yagis had the exact same amount of leakage of the connector, and I say that's very unlikely. What really happens is that water vapor slowly migrates through the outer polyvinyl jacket, through the braid, into the foam, and as water migrates into that foam, water is an extremely lossy material at radio frequencies. That is the method by which your microwave oven works. The RF energy hits the water gets hot by absorbing the RF energy and it's dissipating your beautiful RF energy. In the case of a microwave oven, it's good. In the case of coax cable, it's bad. So, does the new 9914 do the more modern cables have a hermetically sealed foil? Not just a foil wrap, but a foil outer coating, which will give you a good weather seal so that the water cannot migrate. Water vapor will slowly, it takes a couple of years to happen, but it will migrate through a polyvinyl jacket. My normal scuba gear, you know, self-contained underwater breathing apparatus, a person who is into diving will think that a piece of tubing made out of polyvinyl chloride is a beautifully waterproof tubing. Well, you don't sit underwater for 5 solid years, and your cable outdoors is experiencing all kinds of ultraviolet exposure and rain and temperature extremes in summer, winter, spring, and fall, and whatever. Water finds a way to slowly migrate through that polyvinyl chloride, and it gets inside. A metal jacket, like hardline cable, no problem. You get the 70-ohm hardline cable that's used by the cable TV company. Yes, it also has an outer jacket of polyvinyl chloride, but the aluminum outer jacket is the hermetic seal. And as such, you can directly bury that cable in the ground for 20 years. As long as you've installed the connectors correctly, you get no problem. So whenever I see faster velocity factor than 66%, I know there's foam. I know that foam is capable of absorbing water. And so the next question is, if it's foam, like in the case of cable TV cable, where the outer jacket is hardline aluminum, no problem. If it's a flexible cable, then I'm worried, because the water will walk through the braid like it's not even there, and it walks through the polyvinyl chloride outer jacket slowly, but it does it in years of time. If there is the equivalent of a hardline outer jacket by way of a real hermetically sealed foil underneath, then you'll have no problem. So I like to put up a piece of cable. I take my own sweet time installing the connectors, do a good job, and if I'm lucky, I'll use that cable outdoors on top of the tower for 10 or 15 years. Many guys say, you're crazy. You should be replacing your cable every 3 years. And who cares if it takes 5 years for the water to get in and give you trouble? I'm replacing it in 3 years. Well, there are people who have that philosophy. And so you now know some of the pros and cons as I see it. Whiskey 2, Papa November Juliet, K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2KY, what are the comments?
Go ahead, Bell.
Okay, I've been using 9914 outside now for years. I got quite a bit of it outside because it's not only one antenna, it's quite a number of antennas that I have here. And we used to deal with Belden when I was working. We used to buy, for a while there, I think we were one of the largest of their purchasing companies. And because we were running through thousands and thousands of pieces a week. And in conversation at one time, I asked about, you know, the problems they had with the 9913. The guy, he did admit to, you know, the person I was dealing with there, sort of admitted to it, you know, begrudgingly. But he said with the 9914, he said we objected it to every test that's possible with other make cables. And the Belden 9914 was the one that exceeded everybody else's cable as they can, and this was really because they were selling it to the government. And so the whole gang of techs at the 9914 that exceeded every probable test that they could throw at them. So I bought a big roll of it, and so far it's up there now about 8 years. 8 years and no antenna so far has shown me any kind of problem. The 9914, of course, has the number 10 solid, whereas the other ones, of course, go to, you know, the 213 series, go to number 13 flex solid, a flex type, and stranded flex, whereas the 9914 has just a solid sensor. It's called the FPE casing, which of course stands for foam polyethylene. So I can only say that I've had a lot of success so far with the 9914. No complaints. Go ahead.
Okay. Now, that's 9914, and Bob is asking us about 8214 Belden cable. And so I'm not as familiar with that one. And so you now know some of the things I think you should look for, Bob, depending on how many years you would like to be able to use that cable. W2PNJ, you got it, Bob.
Okay, yeah, I was just going to ask, but I think he answered my question. The 8214 has a stranded center conductor, which is good to use with a rotator. And K2KEY was saying that the 9914 has a solid center conductor. So I'm trying to stay away from that for movement. And interesting thing, the 8267, on their catalog sheet, which I printed off the website, has a maximum power rating at 50 megahertz of 1,122 watts, whereas the 8214 does not list the power rating at all. Over to you, Dick. K2KEY W2PNJ.
Yeah, if the cable has similar outer diameter and similar insertion loss or lower insertion loss, that really says the amount of heat it's going to generate is very similar or better. And as such, it should take it. I personally have put 1,000 watts to RG8 cable, solid polyethylene, for 10 or 15 solid minutes. And the cable comes close to melting, but doesn't quite melt. 1,000 watts, 432 megacycles. At 2 meters, unless you're running multiple gallons, I don't think you're going to run into problems of failure of the cable. You're also very smart to not use solid semiconductor around a rotator. Solid center conductor has extremely high torsional stiffness. So as your rotator rotates back and forth, you think the cable is bending. And on the outside, it's winding itself up like a watch spring, and yes, it looks like it's bending. The center conductor is doing some strange things. The net result is that the center pin of the type N connector, the male pin, is continuously being rotated into the female connector as you swing the rotator back and forth, and slowly grinding up that beautiful gold plating that's there and making metal chips. So around a rotator, my favorite cable around a rotator is RG9 or RG214, double shielded solid polyethylene cable. It's higher in loss, but there's only a couple of feet of it being used, and because it's solid polyethylene, it can't suck up the water. It's nice and flexible, and it solves my problem. It's my favorite cable around a rotator. Lots of guys have used Hogline up the tower, and then they use Superflex, things like that around the rotator, but they eventually experience some fatigue failure. Braided cable there, double shielded braided cable, I think is appropriate around a rotator. So I guess it's going to take a little bit of further study. There probably are some websites giving further information about some of these cables. Back to you. W2PNJ, K2LIW.
Let me make one more comment about
Ahmed, W2OSR.
67, Dick, and the 9914.
Okay. We got both Mel and Bob, but with some further comments. Mel first, go ahead.
Okay, now as far as using the 9914 around a rotating situation, what they recommend, I discussed this with them, you take the 9914 and you make a one-turn loop, just like a looks like you would be making a coil, and then a loop right next to it before it a little bit, and it will turn back and forth with the rotor, no problem at all. I did that, and it's gone back and forth a heck of a lot of times, and so far so good. The 8267 is a type 213 cable. It is not like the RG8. It's not RG8 style like the 9914. It's style 213, Dick, over.
Yeah, 213, I think, is single braid, and RG214 is double braid. And I like the extra strength of the double braid around the rotator. I don't want the Don connector being ripped off the end of the cable. Bob, W2OSR, let's have your comments, sir.
Okay, Dick, W2OSR. I'm using a different cable. Got it for a good price. That's the main one with it. 55 cents a foot these days for coax is relatively inexpensive, and you'll have to ask me in a couple of years of how well it held up, but I'll give you the specification on it. It's IEWC number 9096-2A. It's called ExtraFlex right here in the States. Other than IEWC, I'm not sure who the manufacturer is. As I remember, the loss for 100 foot was 0.7 dB, so it's a low loss cable. The velocity factor, I think, was 86, but I won't swear to it. That's what I remember. Back to you.
That sure sounds like an awful nice cable. My favorite kind of cable for the highest reliability is Hardline. And lots of people are scared to death to run Hardline if they've never done it before, because they have the impression that there should be one single piece of cable running from the antenna down to the back of the rig and no interruptions in between. It's an ideal situation if you can get it. However, if you have to run Hardline up the tower, go through a connector, male-female connector combination to go through a flexible piece to go around the rotator, and then maybe another piece of Hardline that goes into the phasing harness of a great big array of Yagis. You can do that at the top. At the bottom, you have another transition from Hardline into flexible cable in order to go through the hole in the house that brings the cable into the house. That should be a flexible piece of cable. The average guy is scared to death thinking that each individual type N connector or each UHF connector has half a dB of loss. They absolutely, positively do not have anything like that. The loss is like 0.03 dB, a connector. And you can prove that to yourself real fast by putting a kilowatt through the connector for 10 solid minutes and finding out how hot it gets. That's an extremely sensitive test. A couple of watts of heat represents something like 0.02 dB of loss. And so, connectors don't have loss. You got to be careful. Each individual connector is capable of leaking water into the system. You got to try very hard to keep water out of your connectors and out of your cable. Very lossy stuff. It's dummy load. But I'm not afraid of transitioning from Hardline to other kinds of cable at both ends. I'll admit that for a guy who runs a crank-up tower, the attractiveness of Hardline kind of disappears. Unless you're a good mechanical engineering genius, to run Hardline up a tower that has crank-up, very few people have done it. I know of a couple guys who have succeeded
but they had to work a little hard at it. So, these are some more opinions on the subject of cable transmission lines, Bob. W2PNJ, H2RIW.
Dave, one last question. The RG213 has a mil-spec number with it, whereas the 8214 does not. The overall diameter on the RG213 is 0.405, whereas the other one is 0.403. So we're talking like 2/1000 of an inch larger in diameter. I don't think that's going to have an effect on the standard coax connector over the years.
I tend to agree with you there, Bob. Also, whether it is made or is not made to a mil spec is not super important in my opinion. Most things that are mil spec are a hell of a lot higher in price simply because you're guaranteeing uniformity from roll to roll. Well, I personally have seen the problem where you take foamed cable, in my case it was FM8, and two consecutive rolls. One roll will have a velocity factor of 82%, and the next roll will have an 85% velocity factor. The density of the foam changes. On top of that, if it's a 5,000-foot roll that it came from, the beginning of the roll, the middle of the roll, and the end of the roll are different. As such, there are times when you can buy what's called mill ends. In other words, the mill that made the cable recognizes the fact that the beginning of the run and the end of the run will have a different density. And so it doesn't pass the mill spec, which has to be, we'll say, 82% velocity factor plus or minus 1%. In general, unless you're building a phasing harness, you don't really care if the cable you bought you thought was 82% and it turns out to be 85% velocity factor or vice versa. Whereas in a military environment where it's used as part of a phasing harness, that would create an error in the electronic beam steering network of the antenna, and that would not be acceptable. So the lack of mil spec doesn't scare me as I see it. If it's got the right materials inside that you like and you've got the right kind of a connector that goes on there and gives you a good weather feel and a good mechanical feel, there's a hell of a lot of cables that people will think are no good that I think are great. For years and years, people show up.